This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. At the end of this first week of the new year, we're going to take a look at the issues making headlines these past few days in our Week in Review. We've got Senator Elizabeth Warren confirming her re-election bid today and some of the battles shaping up on Capitol Hill.
The first order of business is to repeal and replace Obamacare.
That's Vice President-elect Mike Pence speaking Wednesday after meeting with some congressional Republicans. Also this week, President Obama met with congressional Democrats, including Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark. She announced that she's sitting out the presidential inauguration later this month.
We have a situation here where the Republicans are willing to push the American people out of the airplane with no parachute.
And state lawmakers laid out their agendas when they were sworn in this week. Joining us to talk about all of this and more are our panelists, Renee Loth. She's editor of Architecture Boston Magazine and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to see you.
Happy to be here.
Also with us is a new voice, D.R. Tucker, political contributor to Washington Monthly and Cube Innovations. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Welcome and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. So before we get to Capitol Hill and Senator Warren's announcement today about her reelection bid, let's start on Beacon Hill. State Senate President Stan Rosenberg was reelected to lead the Senate this week. And shortly after that, he came on our show to tell us about some of his priorities. Let's listen.
We have a responsibility to look to the future and make sure that we're addressing two of the fundamental pillars of our economy, which is an educated workforce and a transportation system that supports getting goods and people to where they need to be as efficiently as possible, and preferably in a way that reduces our carbon footprint and our impact on climate change.
And on the House side, Speaker Robert DeLeo said this.
One of our first order's priorities is going to have to be addressing the marijuana issue.
Governor Baker also said the issue of recreational marijuana legislation is front and center this session. Is this the main issue facing lawmakers right now, Renee?
Well, you know, the people always complain about how the there's one-party rule in on the Beacon Hill. You know, that the legislature, at least, is controlled overwhelmingly by Democrats. But Stanley Rosenberg and Bobby DeLeo might as well be from two different parties. I mean, they really don't agree on many things. They represent opposite wings, really, of the Democratic Party. Here's DeLeo. He's much more conservative. He wants to hold the line on taxes. He's very concerned about the marijuana legislation. And then here's Rosenberg on the other side, who is, you know, in his opening address, talked about income inequality and supports the millionaire's tax that's likely to be on the ballot next year. So I see these two leaders of the two branches of the legislature as being, not in lockstep and in many ways opposed to each other.
How do you think that'll play out? Do you think we'll see a lot of battles?
Well, I mean, I think we did in last year actually see sometimes some rather personal battles between Rosenberg and DeLeo, with Charlie Baker kind of as the peacekeeper between the two. So I think we may see more of that. To the extent they can focus on policy, I think that would be better for everybody.
You know, the governor told reporters this week that he plans on pushing an economic growth agenda and continuing to fight the opioid crisis. This is what the governor said.
We're going to continue to work on the addiction issues, which have been a major opportunity for us to work with our colleagues and with others here in the Commonwealth. I still talk to too many people who feel that people who are dealing with addiction are uncomfortable speaking about it because there's a certain stigma associated with it. I think we need to continue to make progress on that.
Now, there has been a lot of talk about the governor's budget cuts, especially cuts that affect addiction treatment services. And some accuse the governor of saying that he's committed to the opioid epidemic and reducing stigma, but his actions not necessarily supporting that. DR, what's your take?
He's committed to taking action in theory. It's hard to sort of lead on this sort of issue if you're not willing to invest in taking action on this issue. And this goes back to the whole sort of ideological thing of believing that, you know, you don't need new revenue in order to address problems. And somewhere along the line, you do get the sense that at some point there has to be a serious conversation about the need for more revenue to address problems like opioid addiction.
Right.
It's not going to solve itself, basically.
Right. Baker's still wildly popular, though. He's very, very, very popular governor. Do you see that changing at all?
Well, when people always ask me about Baker's popularity, I always say that, you know, There was a time when George W. Bush was very, very popular, and look what happened. So popularity is one of those things where it may appear to last, and then it just takes one issue, one controversy, and all of a sudden things start turning around, and they could turn around, especially on this issue, when you look at all the so many people in this state suffering from the consequences of the opioid crisis, and when you realize that the money is not there because of the whole mentality of we can't raise 1 cent in revenue, well, at some point that popularity might begin to take a dip.
Right. Yes. No. Speak.
I just think.
Go ahead.
I think that's very well put. You know, I think that this is a problem for Baker on a number of fronts. You know, his sort of lockstep opposition to any kind of increase in taxes, which of course does contribute to his popularity with the voters, and how does that reconcile with his, I think, sincere commitment to trying to do something about the opioid crisis. But, you know, without being able to get any money behind it, you know, talking about stigma, that doesn't cost anything. You know, trying to change people's attitudes, that's very nice. But ultimately, people need treatment, and they need treatment when they want it. You know, in the moment, when they decide they're ready to get treatment, there has to be a bed available for them right then. And that's always been our problem in the state, and it's still a problem.
Also, speaking of Governor Baker, he did announce that he will be attending President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration later this month. The Clintons are going, former President George W. Bush going. But yesterday, Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark said she's going to skip it in protest. And this comes a day after she told us on Radio Boston that she would be willing to work with the administration on issues where there is common ground. In skipping the inauguration, what do you think? Is this something that is a big statement on her part and perhaps a dangerous one? Dr.
I don't think it's a dangerous statement at all. She has the right to decline attendance, and others have a right to attend if they so choose. Catherine Clark has basically made it quite clear that, you know, when she looks at the agenda that President-elect Trump is trying to implement, that's not something that one necessarily, in her opinion, wants to endorse with her physical appearance. And that's totally fine. Just as, you know, I note that there's some controversy about Hillary Clinton wanting to attend, and she has a right to attend as well. It's an individual choice, basically.
Well, we did get a statement from the Mass GOP. It said this narrow-minded partisan stunt on the part of Congresswoman Clark shows that she cares more about scoring political points than respecting democracy. It says, quote, her boycott of the inaugural is such an extreme rejection of bipartisan tradition that even her Democratic colleagues won't join her. Renee, what do you say to that?
Well, that's sort of the pot calling the kettle black, isn't it? I mean, you know, the Democrats certainly don't need to take lessons about, you know, partisan gridlock and obstruction from the Republican Party or the other way around. I don't think it's going to hurt Kit Clark. She's a rising star in the Democratic Party in the sort of Elizabeth Warren wing, although Elizabeth Warren is attending the inauguration as DR says, it's a personal choice. I do think that the Democrats need to really take seriously their watchdog role in this next 4 years. I mean, the Trump administration and his supporters, and he's not even sworn in yet, are very good at distracting the American people from their quiet dismantling of democracy, which I see as a real serious possibility. You know, the hearings on the cabinet appointees, the Trump administration has scheduled something like six of them on the same day, at the same time that Donald Trump is going to have his first much-delayed press conference. So, there's going to be tons of distractions. It's going to be very difficult for the press and for other watchdog organizations to really give the scrutiny that those cabinet appointees deserve, and that's the role of the Democratic Party, I think. You know, going to the inauguration or not is really just symbolic.
You know, speaking of which, we heard from Seth Moulton, who spoke with us earlier this week as well, about the incoming administration, and this is what he said about Democrats and Trump's policies. Let's listen.
So much of what Donald Trump said during the campaign and has said since the campaign is dangerous for working families. His economic plans are disastrous, dangerous for our troops. He has no clue about foreign policy, and he's going to put young lives at risk.
And DR, I wonder what your take is on the members of the Massachusetts all-Democratic delegation pretty much operating in the Trump era.
Well, there is something to be said for embracing the ethos that turnabout is fair play. If members of the delegation believe that Trump's agenda is injurious to democracy, injurious to the public. They are well within their rights to basically do whatever it takes to say no to that agenda, just as when Republicans believe that President Obama's agenda was injurious to democracy, they were obviously politically well within their rights to do the same. I mean, there is something to be said for believing that sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, and that, you know, that Democrats should do unto Republicans what Republicans have done unto them.
But do you think, how do you think this will affect us here in Massachusetts? Any predictions from either of you?
Well, there obviously could be some degree of backlash. I mean, we recall when President Nixon, I believe after he was reelected in 1972, he vetoed, I believe, I think it was the Charleston Navy Yard, or there was some specific project that he vetoed out of revenge for the fact that the state went for George McGovern. And we could see that sort of vindictiveness from the president-elect. But if that does indeed happen, I'm sure that the congressional delegation will be quite vocal about the nature of what he's doing.
You know, earlier we mentioned Senator Warren, who did announce today that she is, in fact, running for reelection. No big surprise there. But what do you think her role is going to be like, especially after Inauguration Day? I mean, she's already considered sort of the voice against the president-elect. Is that going to strengthen, do you think, Renee?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I just said, it's important to really take seriously this watchdog role that the opposition party or the minority party, you know, traditionally has. And she's very good at this. She also, you know, she's not shy about calling out what she sees to be serious attacks on our democratic system, small d. But I also think that she, you know, is a lawyer, and she understands some of the legal, sort of the murky legal areas that the Trump administration has, or that Donald Trump, president-elect, has said that he's wading into. So I think she'll be able to call those out with some authority.
I want to talk about some other news this week that's got national political ramifications. Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson offering president-elect Trump his inmates to help build the wall on the Mexican border. Now, we should say the president-elect has not responded to this proposal, but here's Hodgson explaining it Wednesday.
I'd like to see us do this. I think it's really worthwhile. You know, these are people that have low self-esteem, don't think that they really can accomplish something, who would be involved in a national initiative that they can come back and say, hey, listen, I made a difference. We've seen it in our own county.
I wonder, DR, your reactions to this proposal from Sheriff Hodgson.
I think this is a proposal that's going to go nowhere by virtue of the fact that I don't believe that this effort to sort of build a wall is going to go anywhere. The only wall we're going to see is on an old Pink Floyd album, basically. the whole initiative to try to build a wall, and I know that the Congress is trying to come up with some sort of funding for it. I guess the proposal of having Mexico pay for it has now been tabled. It's going to be, I predict it's going to play out similar to George W. Bush trying to reform as he viewed it Social Security and how that went nowhere. And I think Sheriff Hodgson is simply sort of engaging in a fair bit of a self-promotion. But this whole proposal to sort of, you know, get inmates to build a wall is just all theory and all fiction and no fact, basically.
We did speak with Vincent Schiraldi about this. He's a senior research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Program in Criminal Justice, and he was head of juvenile corrections for Washington, D.C., and this is what he said about Sheriff Hodgson's plan.
A lot of good could come from having people who have run afoul of the law repay their debt to society by doing works in the community, and it's a real shame to start that with probably the most divisive public works project perhaps in the history of America.
So, Renee, I'm wondering, is there, you know, a public benefit to having inmates help in big public work projects like this? And then, of course, what are some of the pitfalls that maybe aren't so obvious even?
Yeah, you know, actually, Charlie Baker, when was sort of cornered by this or surprised by this proposal of the sheriff's, was asked about it. He said he'd rather see the inmates working on projects closer to home. That was how he managed to get out of that quandary. This is totally in keeping with Sheriff Hodgson's, you know, MO. He is has a reputation as a tough guy, shoots from the hip. I think he sees this Donald Trump's election as his moment. You know, it's tempting to dismiss this as kind of, amusing or, impossible. But, of course, a lot of people dismissed Donald Trump and some of his wackier ideas initially, too. So I would say, though, that, almost half of the inmates in the Bristol County, Corrections Department are pre-trial detainees awaiting trial. They have not yet been convicted of anything either, right? So the idea of rounding them up into some sort of indentured servitude and sending them down to Mexico or Texas to build a wall, it doesn't pass the constitutional smell test, or even maybe the laugh test. So I think this project's going nowhere.
But I wonder, it raises questions, doesn't it? You mentioned, Sheriff Hodgson's past and other controversial moves that he's made. He's charged inmates for being incarcerated, and he's sort of done these things unilaterally. It raises the question of, can a sheriff just do this, and groups would need to sue to make a sheriff stop? I mean, what do we know about that?
Sheriffs really do run their own fiefdoms. I mean, he's an elected, public official. He's been reelected twice, I think, his third term, I believe. And so, the people of Bristol County seem to not be too upset with some of his more, controversial statements. So I think within his own department, he stopped serving orange juice to the inmates. He got rid of TV and smoking and, put together these chain gangs, right? You may recall, shackled those workers who were out on the highways, cleaning them up and so on. So within his own department, I think he's able to do quite a lot. But when he steps into, other jurisdictions, I think it's a lot murkier.
Let's talk about a study that came out this week, because there were some dramatic numbers in that study. It was a study done by the Boston Women's Workforce Council in City Hall, and it found that working women in Boston, on average, make 23% less than men, 77 cents on the dollar, and that there's a gender wage gap, a significant one. And this is the first time that researchers have used data collected directly from employers to prove that there is a gender wage gap. Here's Mayor Marty Walsh.
This is a groundbreaking moment in tackling the gender gap. And this isn't about us talking about filing legislation and passing legislation and kind of waiting to see what happens with that legislation. This is Boston and the council taking action on how do we actually deal with and work on the wage gap.
D.R. Tucker, I wonder, what's your reaction to this? Do you think we'll see some changes because of this report?
I definitely hope so. Equality is always better, I say. And I couldn't help noting, reading the story in the Boston Globe, when you go to the comment sections of the story, you have all these people denying that it's real, denying that the wage gap is real, sort of like when they do the climate change stories and people deny that climate change is real. I mean, they're not making this up. This is a chronic problem. It needs to be remedied. My line is that a woman should make a dollar for every dollar a man earns. Mm. And it's good to see that Mayor Walsh, and it's good to see the business leaders in Greater Boston taking this seriously and trying to lead on this, because, again, it just makes not just moral sense, it makes economic sense to reduce the wage gap to nothing, to where, you have equal pay, truly equal pay for equal work. There was a law that was passed last year basically saying that, employers can no longer question women about how much they earned previously by virtue, because, doing that essentially traps women in lesser wage jobs for their entire careers. And it's a good thing that the legislature passed that, but so much more needs to be done, and I believe will be done by Mayor Walsh and by the business leaders in Boston.
Now, many folks have said that these numbers are skewed to a certain degree. They're not completely accurate. That's why they say it's not real, right? Because they say, well, women take time off, they raise children, they tend to be the homemakers more, they want a flexible schedule. So when you compare the salaries, it's like comparing apples and oranges and not apples to apples. Do you think, Renee, that this report gets rid of that argument?
No, I think there's some truth to that, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't intend to blame the victim at all in this, what I'm about to say. But, our society continues to be set up in such a way that women do take more time off for child caring or parent, the care of their elderly parents and so on. And that does affect their wages overall. If you look at week to week, it's a little bit more of an apples and apples situation. There are ways to try to adjust for those realities. I think until we start to value the work that women do inside the home, outside the home, and also the types of career choices that women make equally to men, That's what we need to be doing. I mean, there have been studies out of universities that show that the most lucrative college majors, you know, engineering and math and pharmaceuticals, tend to be dominated by men. That's not because they require smarter people or that they're more important to our society or anything. It just means that that the society is set up in such a way that it compensates men more than women for, I would say, comparable but perhaps different work.
Okay, I want to end our conversation with hubbubs. Those are the brief stories or events that maybe didn't make it above the fold this week but caught our attention. DR, what's your hubbub for the week?
My hubbub is the closing of the Phillips Old Colony House and the Freeport Tavern in Dorchester. As someone who was born and raised in Dorchester, it's a really sad story. This restaurant has been sort of an iconic presence in the neighborhood for decades. I have a lot of friends who've had a lot of, you know, events that have taken place at that restaurant, a lot of life events, and it's a really, really sad. But it's sort of the trend of, you know, old restaurants closing and new restaurants coming up. So,
and that's why it's closing? Because somebody new's coming in? Or what?
Apparently the owners are considering basically using it for using the land for different reasons, but still, you know, so many memories to go as a result of that.
All right. Well, bye-bye, Phillips Old Colony House in Dorchester. Renee, what's your hubbub this week?
My hubbub has to do with the continuing saga of the legalized marijuana initiative. The advocates for the ballot measure, who are still reeling from the legislature's sneaky and possibly somewhat secret vote to delay the measure by 6 months, are now facing the likelihood that the senator who authored that delay, Senator Jason Lewis of Winchester, a Democrat, may be appointed to head a new committee to address aspects of the law. In other words, the legislature is setting up a new committee to look at the marijuana law, and that the senator who is an opponent of the original ballot measure may be appointed to lead that. So the advocates are all up in arms about this. I personally was actually not in favor of the initiative. I thought it was there were going to be a lot of problems, which we're starting to see now in rolling it out. But I do think it underscores how important it is that the legislature needs to move quickly to appoint the 3-member cannabis control commission that the legislation calls for, and just get this, you know, appoint neutral and respected members of that commission and just get this out of politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we don't have the same issues we had with medical marijuana.
Exactly. But that's my editorial.
Okay. Well, mine is completely silly. Can I say a little cheeky? This Sunday, the Boston Society of Shenanigans will be holding its annual No Pants subway ride on the MBTA. More than 100 people are expected to board the T and drop their pants unexpectedly, wearing their underwear. This is the 9th annual No Pants subway ride. And so when the MBTA was contacted about this, a spokesman said the T has no position on this event. So I think that's my hubbub for the week, and I'm sticking with it. And pants are staying on. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston Magazine and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you.
Thank you.
D.R. Tucker, it's great to hear you, political contributor to Washington Monthly and Cube Innovations. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Stay with us. Coming up, a preview of the spring real estate market in Greater Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.